I think the mistake I was making, and maybe many people make, is that to think that all of knowledge is like neatly separated into these little bins, like the evolution bin is separate from the chemistry bin. But the truth is that all of knowledge, I mean, maybe this sounds a bit trite, but all of knowledge is very connected, in fact. And in fact, the most revolutionary science is done through bridging fields that might have been separate for decades or centuries even, like evolution and chemistry, for example.
Welcome to the Baker Lab podcast. I'm Ian Hayden with the University of Washington.
I'm David Baker, the director of the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington.
My name is Arvind Pillai, and I'm a postdoctoral scholar in the Baker Lab.
There are many paths into protein design. Some people like Arvind are attracted to protein design because of the appeal of understanding what you make. Other people are attracted because of the problems that you can solve. And it's really in the center of many, many different disciplines and the center of many different things that are relevant to current life. So it's kind of neat how many different ways there are in.
In his PhD, Arvind studied the evolution of hemoglobin. He mapped the key mutations that gave these proteins the ability to bind and function together. And he said just two or three changes were enough to glue them together, and that really surprised them.
What I remember about the first time I learned about Arvind's work was, it was a long time ago when I still used to travel and get on planes, which I don't do anymore. But I was visiting his lab at the University of Chicago, and his advisor told me I should talk to him. And I was really struck by Arvind. He was incredibly intensely interested in three substitutions and what they could do. And he'd devoted a couple years of work to figuring it out. And I think that kind of he gets extremely fascinated by things that are really fundamental to understanding a problem, but other people might just miss.
To begin, Arvind, can you tell me a bit about where you're from and maybe what drew you into science?
I think the fundamental through line of my experience has been that I've been an immigrant since the very beginning. I have like 3 decades of being an immigrant, which is pretty weird. I was born in the UAE in Sharjah, which is an emirate in the United Arab Emirates. I was born there as an Indian citizen, grew up in this sort of middle-class Indian community. And I think I got into science pretty early on. My parents were in STEM fields. Like, my mom was a doctor and my dad was an engineer. But I think deep down, even when I was a kid, I was sort of a pretty imaginative person. I was really interested in the ability of science to like peel back like layers of reality that you don't have access to with your regular senses. And I think the most exciting thing to me as a kid was the history of life on Earth. So there was this book I had, Prehistoric Life by Michael Benton, and it was like torn apart from use. So because it gave me this window into this world of like animal and plant empires that had existed in the past, this whole story stretching back like 3.5 billion years. And it was crazy to me that my mundane existence came at the tail end of all these insane catastrophes and renewals of life and all this change. And that just kind of blew my mind, because the ability of humans to access that was through the scientific method. And I think it just, the excitement to my imagination, and I've always also been of an artistic bent. And I think there's a like a creative and a very imaginative side to science, and that's what attracted me to that. So this book was illustrated, the artistic side of science was also revealed there, because this whole like genre of art called paleo art, where you reconstruct kind of ancient landscapes, you know, amphibians like trawling around like these lush carboniferous forests.
I think I've seen these in like museums.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
like, it'd be like watercolor or like, they're yeah. often beautiful illustrations, but like scientifically informed. That's what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you go to the Field Museum, you can see work from the early 1900s from Charles Arknight, where like you can see him trying to depict like, you know, T-Rexes or saber-toothed cats and stuff, informed by the science of the time, which has evolved over time. So like modern day reconstructions of dinosaurs would have like feathers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a kind of an interesting exercise. And actually, that was something I enjoyed a lot, was drawing like ancient animals. I probably did picture books full from my youth of like just drawing like plesiosaurs or pterodactyls or saber-toothed cats and so on.
Were you like tracing the figures in these books, or were you even at that age like really getting into art and making your own original illustrations? And
No, actually, I was more or less drawing it by myself. I think I basically learned the basic form of like a theropod dinosaur or a sauropod dinosaur. I could like replicate that pretty quickly. I definitely was a lot better at drawing that than drawing humans, for example.
You were a science kid. Okay. So did you go into college wanting to pursue sciences or tell me about that?
Yeah. So this is kind of an interesting path for me. So you might wonder, like, why am I a molecular engineer now, given that I was interested in...
I would assume you're an archaeologist.
Yeah. A paleontologist.
Artist,
or an artist. And yeah, it was a bit of a journey from there to where I am now. I think the background to this is like where I grew up. While science was valued, it was viewed as like a path to middle-class affluence. So like it was a path to becoming a doctor or an engineer of some kind. The idea of knowledge for its own sake maybe wasn't as valued. And I didn't even know that the job that I ultimately do now existed in any form. Like I don't think any of my immediate family members had that much experience with science as like not just a body of knowledge you use to pass tests, but like a process that can be used for knowledge discovery, and that knowledge actually being really revolutionary and even almost like spiritually informative in some way. It reveals worlds that we don't have access to. Of course, I've brought up paleontology and stuff, but there's also deep space or the nanoscale of the universe, basically, that is also incredible and mind-boggling. I felt like it wasn't fully captured in my schooling experience. We had this strong, like, Indian middle-class achievement ideology where the purpose of education is to get ahead and get the job that gets you financial security and stability.
Kind of a functional understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when I came to the U.S. For undergrad, I went to the University of Texas at Austin. And the reason I had to leave my home country was essentially because there were no significant educational opportunities that rival what you find in the U.S. So almost everyone from my high school had to leave the country. Not least of which, because none of them were citizens, and without either going to school or having a job, you couldn't really stay in the UAE. So when I came here, I don't think I had a very strong sense of what my ultimate career goals would be. I was doing cellular molecular biology, but I didn't really care about it that much. I didn't so much care as much about the long-term career goals per se. It was just like this revolutionary opportunity once I came to the US to like basically have access to as much knowledge as I wanted, which I definitely did not have access to in the UAE. Like I remember struggling to find information about topics that I found interesting, partly because of the lack of libraries. I mean, of course, the internet, you know, I'm a millennial, so the internet kind of came towards the tail end. Like Wikipedia and stuff was probably towards the tail end of high school. So that was also pretty another major source of information for me. But the thing that blew my mind in the US when I came here was the scale of an American university library.
I've heard that you've been blown away by some libraries in your time.
Yeah, all three of the institutions I was at, UChicago, UT Austin, and UW, have like insane libraries that contain the sum of human knowledge. And if you wanted to know anything about anything, you wanted to know about like, I don't know, like particle physics, or you wanted to know about the Ottoman Empire or something, there's a whole book. There's like rows and rows of books on those subjects. So yeah, I think my first 2 years of college were like me just using all of my time to just read stuff, just random stuff that wasn't even necessarily productive from a like career standpoint, but definitely like feel like it enhanced my knowledge base to a level where, you know, I think I might have even peaked in my second or third year of college in terms of how much I knew about stuff.
It's all downhill.
It's all been a steady decline in literacy since then. But.
So do you remember, were you also taking a bunch of different kinds of classes at that time?
Yeah. Actually, that was the other exciting thing about education in the U.S. is that there was an emphasis on the humanities, for example. So I took a class on anthropology. I took a class on the Bible. I actually read the entire New Testament from beginning to end. And also it was put in historical context. And, you know, in fact, most of the classes I took were not cellular molecular biology classes at the end of the day. I took like PCAM and OCHEM and math and stuff like that. So it was like this rich, diverse experience, which I think is actually not that common in many other countries, I think, like to have that kind of liberal arts education, I guess, like broad base.
I think this is a topic we'll probably get to several times in this episode, but this idea of breadth versus depth, either as an academic, as a student, or as a scientist. And I think it's quite clear from what you just shared that when you were a student early on in your college career, it was a lot about breadth. You had a lot of interests. So let's continue on with college. Did you begin doing research as a college student? And can you tell me about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the fundamental flaw in my approach to my undergraduate experience was my lack of focus on research early on. So the first 2 years, instead of actually getting into a lab, I instead decided to write this like long online history of life on Earth. So it's like a blog where I would go into the geology library, like read everything I could about a given time period or a group of animals, let's say whales or flightless birds, and then write these long pretentious essays about them, send them out into the internet. And of course, I didn't have the SEO optimization knowledge and in general web design skills, but I just hoped that someone out there would read it. And sometimes people did actually read it and email me about it. But that was kind of my focus. And I also decided to volunteer at the Texas Memorial Museum, which was a museum on campus, where I got to give like little tours of the kind of geological history of Texas to lots of different kinds of people. So none of this necessarily terribly useful from the perspective of applying to molecular biology graduate school, which is what in theory I was supposed to be doing. So like this is my third year, I'm applying to graduate school. I have marginal experience, research experience. I had some, but nothing to really write home about. And it's a catastrophe. I get annihilated in the application cycle.
Nobody would accept you into the program.
Nobody would accept me into the program.
Even though you were clearly passionate about science.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe your resume looked, what, maybe scattered to them?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I'm not bitter about this at all, by the way.
Yeah.
No, I am. But but like, I was just, yeah. I mean, basically, I it was kind of strange because I felt like, not an air of grievance here, but essentially, despite the fact that I had this intense interest in the subject and like just independently of any rewards or any career gain or anything like that, like I just was able to pump out these like articles, you know, month after month, basically pretty well researched in my opinion for my 19-year-old brain or whatever at the time. I just wasn't really rewarded for it. And then I realized that I actually had to get practical about like, how am I actually going to get into graduate school? And there's more concerns here than simply following my passion. I also needed to stay in the States because I was like very interested in not going back home, just because my opportunities and the freedoms I enjoyed would be substantially curtailed, I think. So I had to extend my college time by another like 6 months. And then I like basically signed up to work in two labs simultaneously to try and, I don't know that this is necessarily, it's probably appeared like a red flag on my application at the time, given what I know now, but that was the best thing I could do to like try and shore up my actual molecular biology experience, show that I know how to do, you know, PCRs and these other like run gels and all the other things that you're supposed to know as a molecular biology
graduate. So you really doubled down on it.
Yeah.
What stands out to you from that time of maybe shifting gears a little bit or going for more of that depth in a particular subject, two different labs? Did you learn something there or have experiences there that were really unique?
Yeah, I think so. I think what it built is core competency in the lab. I basically learned how to, you know, keep notes and set up controls, understand the system. I think it was also like the first time I started really reading research papers more carefully. I remember writing grants. Even though it was very compressed, I think it was a pretty rounded experience, initial experience in science where I got a sense of how to basically move transparent liquids around and answer questions by doing that. Even to this day, I think I've still inherited things from that very early era, like the way I, you know, played bacteria on a plate or whatever, is still kind of like an evolution from that initial starting point.
Well, speaking of evolution, maybe you can connect some threads here. You described early in life your interest in sounded like paleontology, archaeology, ancient history of life and the earth. And then in undergraduate, you ended up in molecular biology, which is kind of similar to what we do here, but we also do a bit of engineering and other types of approaches here in the Baker Lab. How did you end up in molecular biology?
Yeah. I think the thing that I found a little dissatisfying about paleontology at the end of the day is the lack of straightforward, repeatable experiments. Like it doesn't lend itself to the same kind of reductionist science that molecular biology and biochemistry lend themselves to. You can really know a lot about a protein with very high accuracy. Of course, it's still a very complex system, so it's still quite interesting. But I think that aspect of it was pretty exciting. The ready availability of experimental methods that can really address questions rigorously. Not to say that that doesn't exist in, you know, some arenas in paleontology. You can make like biomechanical models of how this or that animal walked or whatever. But I think, you know, being able to send a protein into mass spec and measure its mass down to the accuracy of within one hydrogen atom. That's insane that you can do that. It's hard to beat that. Also, I like the speed of the experimental cycle. You know, you're usually working with, or at least I usually work with bacteria or yeast. And that was just like the turnover for those experiments was relatively fast, which I
enjoyed. Yeah, they don't have 80-year lifespans, or you're not dealing with generations of change. I see.
And you're not doing complex crossing experiments and trying to maintain mice and rats or even having to kill them. So I think I enjoy those aspects of biochemistry, like reductionist biochemistry. The other reason is I think the interest in both of those was in evolution, and molecular biology was also like at this time starting to be kind of synthesized, I guess, or joined together. Because I think at some point I came to understand that like proteins are basically the most complex molecules in the universe that human beings know about. And the reason they're that way is because of an evolutionary process. And that's like sort of an age-old question, is how complex features arise in the universe, right? Like, and evolution accounts for biological complexity, and proteins are one layer in that story. So I mentioned like the internet became a bigger part of my life, I think, towards the end of high school. And one of my favorite pastimes in that era was actually arguing with creationists on the internet, which was a very fun experience because actually it taught me a lot about how to make arguments and the strengths and weaknesses of different rhetorical strategies, and also really built my knowledge of a lot of science, because creationists are really coming at like the foundations of every science.
If someone's listening and they haven't heard that term, what's a creationist?
Oh, yeah. Well, there are different flavors of creationism, but a creationist basically believes that life and the universe were created at a defined point in time in the current state that they currently are in. So that event could have happened 6,000 years ago, in which case you're a young Earth creationist. There are other kinds of creationists that are old Earth and believe that they believe in deep time and that the millions of years have happened. But ultimately that all the species on Earth have been uniquely created or specially created by God.
It's often tied to religious belief.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, there's variants of it that try to abstract it away from any specific religious belief. That's like intelligent design that just argues that there is an intelligent designer unspecified. But typically in the United States, they're maybe 2 or 3 degrees removed from some form of like evangelical Christianity usually.
So you were arguing with these people online. Tell me a little bit about that experience.
So in a lot of those arguments, like when it concerned the fossil record or something, it was like sort of easy to answer a lot of their concerns. Like, so they'd ask, you know, where did birds come from? And we have like a, at this point, pretty good unbroken succession of fossil forms that connect reptiles to birds, or dinosaurs to their bird descendants. And I felt like those questions I had a good time fielding and answering, but the questions I really had a hard time with were the molecular ones. You know, like there's a famous intelligent design proponent, Michael Behe, who argues that the flagellum is like irreducibly complex. It's so complicated that how could you ever imagine that such a thing could have been built by like a blind stochastic process like evolution?
This is that, I guess it makes me think of sperm cells. They have that tail on the end, and bacteria do too. These are, you're talking, I guess, about like little molecular motors and swimming elements on microorganisms.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You could think of like a little propeller with a tail on it that has to rotate in a certain way, and that kind of pushes cells forward for different purposes, like bacteria or sperm.
So I guess the question there is like, where did that machine come from?
Exactly, yeah. It's made up of these differentiated parts that are very complicated and they have to fit together in this intricate way. How could that have arisen other than through the divine touch of God, basically, is the argument from intelligent design and creationist people. I think that one really did kind of stump me because that system doesn't lend itself in the same obvious way to like these succession of fossil forms, right? These animals in the past that are like kind of missing links in an unbroken evolutionary succession. And that always did bother me. And I think that bothered me so much that it like kind of formed this propelling force for me through science to answer that question in more detail.
Mm. I think we're going to come back to that in the second half of this episode, this idea of molecular machines. I think we'll have more to say. So I think we left off there, you as an undergraduate. So talk me through your experience of getting to graduate school and what was it like being a graduate student? What did you study?
So I'd always had this issue in my mind where I thought that evolution wasn't like something for me to study. It was like a fluffy subject. like all of my peers had gone on to do real things like hard science, like engineering, physics.
This is a trope you hear a lot, I think, especially as an undergrad.
Exactly, yeah. And then they were doing the real science or engineering rather. And I felt like, well, you know, cell and molecular biology is kind of like the hardest science, so I should really focus on that. I think I went through a process of letting go of that the second time around, and I just applied to evolution departments, but with the aim of studying the evolution of biological molecules. So sort of a synthesis of the things before. And actually, I think when you tap into your own internal passion, it actually shows in your personal statement more clearly, and you're more motivated. So, I mean, my advice would be to actually just stick to something you're actually intellectually curious in, not just what's socially approved or will make you look smart. I think you'll have a lot more success that way.
That's interesting. I'm curious, if you think back to that time in your life, was there something you can think of that maybe caused that change in you or helped you have that shift in mindset from, well, maybe my interests are over here, but I can't or I shouldn't pursue them, to then later, actually, it's okay, I will pursue them. What led to that?
Yeah, I think it's the feeling of crushing failure.
Okay.
So to put it in context, I kind of had the Indian mentality of college, which is college is about getting the highest possible grades or marks, as I would call them growing up. And at that problem, I was good. I was good at like rote memorizing a bunch of stuff, you know, vomiting it out on the test day. And also lots of large public universities in the US kind of work this way. It's like mostly multiple choice test exams. So I basically optimized that.
And studying in this case means almost gaming the system.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my goal was to get A's and not really learn the material, but like basically focus on my other intellectual interests, which were like at various points of time could be how windmills work, or it could be like why dinosaurs, certain dinosaurs have really long necks or something like that. I think when it got to this crushing failure, I had to like really reevaluate what my life was about and like how I'm going to proceed and what I'm going to do with it. Like, do I want to just do something because it would make me look smart, or do I want to do something that I find actually exciting? And also, I think I underestimated how quantitative and interesting and multidisciplinary evolution is actually. I mean, it's the foundational bedrock of all of biology. It's the answer to why does this phenomena happen, basically.
And it's still full of mysteries.
And it's still full of mysteries.
Let's jump to graduate school. What did you work on as a PhD student?
Yeah. So I joined the Ecology and Evolution program at the University of Chicago. And I was actually a continuation of that earlier question that I was talking about, the question of like, biology is replete with examples of complex structures at the molecular level.
These flagella.
And it's actually very universal amongst proteins. Like, so basically most proteins are not isolated molecular units. They assemble into like higher order assemblies and structures. And that assembly process is very specific often and is the basis for their function of many proteins. And if you look at the like surfaces that kind of hold these proteins together, they're usually biophysically very intricate. Like there's many, many amino acids that interact with each other in very specific ways. And it's kind of unclear how evolution could have produced those. So what I wanted to do in my PhD, and I had this amazing privilege because of my advisor, Joe Thornton, and also my co-mentor, George Hochberg. They gave me the opportunity to actually find my own model system to answer that question.
Let me pause you right there. For a listener who's not familiar with this idea of a model system,
yeah,
what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I guess maybe a model organism is usually the context you would think of them in. So like a mouse is a system of which we can do a lot of useful experiments that could be informative not only for things, the biology of mice, but also just animals in general or mammals in general.
I guess in the context of like medical research, a mouse is often in a way a stand-in for a human being.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a model for the other thing you care about. We don't actually care about mice that much.
Exactly,
just
yeah.
You said you got to develop your own model system. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So in this context, a model system refers not to an organism, but to a protein that we can use as like a stand-in for all proteins. Because it's easier to do straightforward, rigorous experiments. You have a contained system of parts that you understand well. But it could have general implications. So in my case, what I had to do is find a protein or protein assembly that had evolved across an interval of time where we could tell the steps involved from going from a simple kind of monomer to a complex assembly, if that makes sense. So that process was actually surprisingly difficult. If you look at, say, the flagellum, like we brought up earlier, right? It has so many parts. It's also very conserved. So many, many different bacteria have it. So it's unclear what the intermediate steps are to go from something simpler to something more complicated. Another good, if you want to take like a macroscopic analogy, like take the eye, right? The eye is a very complex organ with many parts. There's a lens, there's a cornea, there's like a retina, etc. But actually, if you look across the tree of life, you can see organisms where it's a much simpler organ. So it's just like a light-sensitive patch of cells. Then there's another one that's maybe a little bit more, there's like an invagination. And another one, there's a lens. And you can reconstruct the series of steps just by comparing across existing organisms as like how you get from a simpler thing to a more complicated thing without necessarily having all of the individual fossils that back that, especially in the case of the eye, which doesn't even fossilize.
Kind of the same problem with protein.
Exactly. Yeah. Proteins don't fossilize. That's the fundamental problem, is that we don't have access to like kind of fossil record for proteins.
Right. It's the reason why you see all these magnificent skeletal structures in museums is because bones stick around.
Exactly.
But all of these delicate molecules and things like organs don't.
Yeah, right. I mean, even things like DNA, which is very stable, that only goes back, I think, a few hundred thousand years at most. You can have some ancient DNA. But with the events that build proteins of today are like on the scale of millions, if not hundreds of millions or even billions of years.
So your model system.
My model system was hemoglobin. So
hemoglobin.
Yeah. So hemoglobin is like the red stuff in blood.
It's in your blood. Yeah.
It's most of the dry weight of a red blood cell. And it's the oxygen carrying protein in blood. It binds to oxygen tightly in the lungs and then releases it in the tissues. So it's like an oxygen binding machine. And it actually is a protein assembly. It's not one protein. It's like four proteins that assemble into like a four clover kind of structure.
The nerds call it a tetramer.
A tetramer,
right?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you look across the tree of life, or related proteins, you'll see that hemoglobin is related to several successive other proteins that are monomers. So, for example, the red protein in your muscle, myoglobin, that's a monomer. So that is not an oxygen transporter. It just binds to oxygen and kind of like holds onto it pretty tightly. Oxygen storage is its purpose rather than like reversibly binding and releasing.
So kind of a related function and in a way a related structure of these proteins.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, each of the monomers in hemoglobin is structurally superimposable on a monomer of myoglobin. So very similar. So we basically hypothesized that at some point in history, like we had this monomeric globin and it evolves like interfaces that essentially glue it into this higher order structure that's more complex, both in terms of having multiple parts, but it also has this unique oxygen transporting function because it needs to know how to bind to oxygen at high concentration and release it at low concentrations, which ultimately comes down to its ability to toggle between different states. Like once you have these individual monomeric building blocks, how do you wire them into more complex structures that can do useful works? Like, for example, like coordinated motions. In hemoglobin's case, right, like basically what assembly into the structure allows is for the individual subunits in the complex to talk to each other, where when one protein binds to oxygen, it tells the next protein, you can bind to oxygen as well, but bind tighter than I did.
There's a term for that, right?
Yeah, cooperativity or allostery.
This is the stuff you run into if you're like taking a biochemistry
class, yeah.
Right?
The ability of like the subunits within like some of these kinds of assemblies and complexes to talk to each other in that way is actually hugely important. It allows for things like all or nothing responses. So basically, you want hemoglobin to bind to oxygen when it's a ton of it, but then release it when there's less of it in the tissues. And that needs internal communication amongst the parts.
I guess the idea there is like in the lungs, where you're breathing in, that's where the oxygen is. And that's hemoglobin's chance to grab a whole bunch of it. And then your heart pumps it through your body and it reaches the tips of your toes where you're depleted in oxygen. And it's somehow sensing that. And that's a signal that says, okay, I'll let go and I'll deposit the oxygen here because it's needed.
Exactly.
That's what we're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's biologically essential. So if that process of assembly or cooperativity is disrupted in some way, that results in pathologies in humans. And not apart from it being bad for it to be broken up, its arisal in the history of life on Earth and vertebrate evolution actually allowed probably access to larger body sizes, for example, because it allows more efficient transport of oxygen, which might previously have relied on just passive diffusion.
Wow. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of giant dinosaurs, but maybe this is even before
that. Oh, this is way before
that. Sort of ocean life.
This is like
getting big.
Yeah, yes. So both us and sharks have hemoglobin, and our common ancestor had hemoglobin. Yeah, so that's about 450 million years ago was when we split paths from sharks. So
we're coming back to this point of these books you were reading as a child of what these ancient vistas used to look like, except now we're kind of looking at the inside of biology rather than what it would have looked like to our naked eyes.
Exactly, yeah. And so like we mentioned, we don't have access to fossils, right? So how do we actually even productively answer this question? So it turns out that if you have tons of protein sequences from tons of organisms and you have a model of sequence evolution, you can actually infer ancestral sequences at various points in the tree of life. And that's exactly what we did. We inferred statistically the most likely probable ancestors of the various intermediates that connect a myoglobin-like ancestor to modern hemoglobin. And then we expressed and purified those things and characterized them, or we tested them in the lab, basically. And that revealed actually the series of steps, structural steps, by which you get from this simple monomer what mutations it takes to drive that process of increasing complexity and also what the impact is on function.
I guess there's a term coming into my mind, de-extinction. Is that what you're kind of talking about? In the lab, you were doing experiments where you sort of back calculated what the sequence probably was in the past, and then you made that molecule, which might have, as a molecule, gone extinct? Or do we think it's still around on Earth?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely gone extinct a long, long time ago.
Oh, so it is kind of resurrection.
Yeah, no, it is ancestral sequence resurrection, or protein resurrection. So like, yeah, so these proteins we resurrected were from 450 million years ago, approximately, if we assume we know the date at which sharks diverged from humans. And so we can kind of plot these events that happened, you know, hundreds of millions of years ago, and also like say what impacts they probably had on like the ability of this system to transport oxygen. And I think one of the most interesting things is that like, if you think about the evolution of complexity historically, like how people like Darwin might've thought about it, usually it's viewed as this small incremental process of change. So you have lots of little changes, that increase the complexity of the system, and each one delivers this increase in fitness over time. And that's basically how the eye was sculpted, let's say, through innumerable tiny changes. I think what we discovered, though, in probing the evolution of protein assembly is that actually there can be just a small number of large effect mutations. So just two or three mutations could be enough to generate like a totally new interface between two monomers and glue them together in a very strong interaction. And in fact, just a few mutations that glue the pieces together is actually sufficient to also confer the allosteric cooperativity I was talking about, where the subunits can kind of talk to each other.
That's interesting. So when you were doing that kind of work, did you find that surprising, that result?
Oh, yeah, it was very surprising. I view these features as very biophysically complicated. So the assumption was that it would take many, many tiny changes to build them. But I think the way it works, not just in this system, but perhaps in other ones, is that you have a small number of mutations that sort of exploit pre-existing features in those molecules. So pre-existing amino acids that are just waiting to form interactions fortuitously, and also just structural connections between the surface and where it binds to oxygen, basically exploiting existing connections between different components of the protein.
This is making me think about something you said earlier. Earlier in your life as a student, what do you think, looking back on that attitude you used to have about evolution or maybe a softer science? This sounds pretty hard to me.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think the mistake I was making, and maybe many people make, is that to think that all of knowledge is like neatly separated into these little bins, like the evolution bin is separate from the chemistry bin.
Well, because they're different classes.
Yeah, they're different classes.
That's how
exactly,
we treat them.
Yeah. And even if you look at and maybe this is also to some extent a historical phenomena, like maybe these fields are sort of separated from each other in some fundamental way. But the truth is that all of knowledge, I mean, maybe this sounds a bit trite, but all of knowledge is very connected, in fact. And in fact, the most revolutionary science is done through bridging fields that might have been separate for decades or centuries even, like evolution and chemistry, for example.
There's that breadth versus depth idea
yeah.
we had talked about before.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, you obviously need to have enough depth that you can actually productively answer questions in a rigorous way. But I think ultimately, breadth is a source of creativity, right? Like it's the union between two circles that never really intersected before is what leads to really revolutionary science, both in my PhD, but also in here in the Baker Lab as well. That's like a foundational aspect of the science we do here.
I would love to get into that. You learned about the Baker Lab and the work happening here while you were a graduate student, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me that story?
Yeah. So there I was in this lab, like manipulating my tiny protein by which I mean not just that it's nanoscale, but my limited system, I should say. Individual mutations at a time, testing them slowly, characterizing each and every little biophysical effect. And I had the sense that like proteins were so fragile. Basically, they were a few mutations away from just falling apart. Like, it kind of blew my mind that evolution could possibly have created this through like a random search, even if it was informed by natural selection and stuff. And the possibility of protein engineering, right? Obviously, I had read papers about it, but my sense of protein engineering was just that, like, it's a process of taking the handiwork of evolution and then just planting a few mutations and making it a little better. In some cases, even using evolution, like just in an artificial context to optimize things that kind of natural selection over billions of years gave us.
Right, this idea of directed evolution.
Exactly,
speed it up by running it in the lab,
yes.
At least for molecules.
Yeah, so the idea is that whatever you're doing, you need to be testing like millions of variants of proteins and then select some of them and then you seed that into the next generation and try and optimize a given function. Okay, so David, in one of his rare in-person appearances, I guess, visited the University of Chicago and gave two talks there. I remember I was like struggling with purifications in my lab and like failing to mutate my protein to get it to do something I wanted to do. Then I remember going into David's talk and just witnessing his ability to create innumerable proteins and protein folds and functions that spanned like an insane range from like enzymes to materials design to, you know, chlorophyll binders and all the stuff that seemed like, and it was pulled out of the raw ether of just random protein space.
This thing we call de novo design.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is a distinction about this lab that we really don't do the stuff you were spending your life doing, which is looking to nature for these templates, for these proven examples of proteins that work and then modifying them. David's talks and the research here focuses on entirely new proteins, building them from scratch.
Yes. Yeah. First of all, there aren't actually that many examples of evolution actually building a protein from scratch. Usually evolution just takes whatever's around a given protein family and then duplicates one of the genes there and generates a new protein that's almost like just a slight variant of the previous protein's function. It never just samples a random sequence space, let's say, like to find a new protein, or does that at a very low rate. So it just amazed me that like humans in this lab had like somehow coordinated their effort to just generate all these totally new protein architectures and functions. And yeah, that just blew my mind. And even though it was like a huge, kind of a large sea change from what I was doing before, of course I was working with proteins, but our focus was on answering these like classical evolutionary biology questions, and proteins were simply an arena in which we could do that in experimental detail. But this work seemed like a space in which I could unleash my creativity. And like anyone after doing a PhD, especially in biochemistry, which takes forever, you kind of exhausted at the end and want to change.
Maybe a little creativity sounds fun.
Yeah, yeah. And that was super exciting to me. And I just wrote to David. I wrote an email to him and he was like, all right, like sent him three references, and then came here and interviewed and then got the job.
So we're going to jump into what you're doing here as a researcher, but before we get into the details of that, I would love to hear, what does a normal day look like for you as a scientist? Start in the morning.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like many people probably have a more defined schedule of what happens each day. I'm kind of more on the winging it side of things. I have a general sense of what needs to be done by the end of the week, but I think I come in, engage in some light banter with my mentees and also with my colleagues. Then I basically start to plan, usually an experiment or some kind of computational run where we'd be trying to design a new protein. Or usually my experiments involve taking proteins that we've designed on the computer and then actually producing them in the real world using E. coli as like a protein factory, and then purifying it. So I would say like I kind of split my time maybe 50-50 between dry lab at the computer and also just expressing and testing my designs.
Had you done that computational stuff before you arrived here?
I had definitely done computational stuff, but in a completely different domain. So we were more concerned with how do sequences evolve just as strings of text, like analyzing things like mass spec data and stuff like that. But I don't think I had really had anywhere near as much computational experience as I then later on developed in the lab. High throughput computing is something I definitely learned in the Baker Lab. It's incredibly powerful.
I think people may not know this, but that's actually a very common story in this lab.
Yeah.
Right? People think, oh, we do computational protein design. everybody must come here as a computer wizard. And it's sometimes that's true. And more often than not, people learn that kind of stuff here.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely learned a lot here. Also, the infrastructure here is set up great for learning and also deploying these methods effectively. One thing I appreciated even when I was in graduate school was like the power of computers to model protein structure and predict them accurately. And that also blows my mind. I think I've reached the point where I trust a computer maybe 100 times more than a human being's opinion on whether or not this mutation will do something good or bad for a protein, which is kind of what I was doing, by the way, in graduate school. I was just rationally with my human brain trying to like manipulate proteins, saying like, oh, if I introduce this different amino acid here, it'll have this different function. And that's something I would never do today. I would use a computer or some kind of computational model to actually tell.
Including probably tools that didn't exist at the time.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of this stuff really just got built.
At the time I was skeptical about the utility of computers in biology was when I was in graduate school, and I think all that people used computers for was word processing and some very old, not very good games. So I ridiculed anyone who sat at a computer. But that changed for me when I started my postdoc and there was a computer terminal on my desk the first day. And so I had to learn about computing and programming, and I began to gradually see the utility and power of it. Computers and computation have been central to what the lab's been doing for us almost from the beginning. I mean, we developed Rosetta just a couple years after we started. And so really the work has been to develop improved computational models and to use them to design proteins and answer biological questions. And what's happened recently with the AI tools is we've just gotten much, much better at that. So we can design much more complex proteins and answer much more complex questions.
In my time in this lab, one of the greatest privileges has been to witness, like, I would say, an at least medium-scale scientific revolution. So I joined in the year 2021, maybe 1 or 2 months before this deep learning-based protein structure prediction model, AlphaFold 2, came out. And I witnessed the dramatic acceleration in our ability to accurately design proteins, and things that were almost impossible when I started my postdoc basically became on borderline trivial.
When I was a student in the lab, I did a master's here doing enzyme research. It's 2025 now. I showed up in 2015. The project I worked on for about 2.5 years is basically what our visiting students do over a summer. The tools are just so much better than what I used to suffer through and what used to be possible in this field. And it seems like every year there's an acceleration in that space.
Yeah. And by the way, that goes back to the whole breadth thing as well, right? Because machine learning and protein biochemistry were fields essentially like ships in the night passing each other, not really interacting with each other on the scale of decades. And then in the last decade, or not even the last decade, in the last half decade, there's like been this union between the two, which has been insanely productive.
They crashed right into each other.
Yeah. And then I suppose a beautiful new boat emerged the synthesis of the two.
Kind of like myoglobin.
Yes. Yeah. But... that was another really exciting aspect of this lab, was coming here, and I think my scientific horizons were dramatically broadened coming here and like on the regular interacting with people who are, you know, in materials design or machine learning or real chemists or physicists. And that was very, very exciting for me, especially given my breadth focused mind, I guess.
So Arvind, how would you explain your current research to someone who doesn't know a lot about proteins?
Maybe I'll start by saying that most proteins are not static objects. So they're able to change in their shape and function depending on their context. And that's a very fundamental to all of biology. It's what allows cells to rapidly respond to signals. It allows work to happen inside the cell. Like you can imagine little machines kind of analogous to propellers or rotors that have to spin in a certain way. All of that relies on the ability of proteins to change their shape in a dynamic way. Historically, in the lab, we've made proteins that were essentially like rocks. They stay in one state forever. They're really good at being in that state. In fact, they're hard to like make unfold or destroy, but they're not moving. When I joined the lab, this new frontier was opening up of the ability to like actually make proteins that toggle between different shapes. And that would enable a whole range of different useful applications. Like you can think of like precision medicine, where you want a drug to only be released in a certain, like let's say a tumor environment and not in other environments. And that relies on it adopting a new state basically when it encounters the appropriate stimulus. So if you remember from my graduate work, I was essentially working on how this complex oxygen transporting machine evolved and how it gained the ability to toggle between different states. And that's key to its transporting function. When I came into the Baker Lab, I remember thinking, okay, that's what I want to design. I want to make a system that mimics that level of complexity.
So in your system with hemoglobin, what was remarkable there was that it one of its functions, one of its most sophisticated functions is in the lungs where there's oxygen, it behaves one way. And out elsewhere in the body where it needs to release oxygen, it toggles, it switches and behaves a different way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And the historical context of this is that we've never really, until the last few years, been able to build proteins that can mimic that ability to dynamically toggle between different states, even though it's so central to so much of biology, right? Like it's how cells respond to signals, how work gets done inside the cell. And I just wanted to uncover the design principles that will allow us to target those kinds of complex dynamic functions.
Design things that move.
Design things that move and move together. Like complexes with made up of pieces that all coordinate their motion in order to basically do useful tasks.
So what might a useful task look like?
Yeah, so one useful task could be, let's say you have on the molecular scale, a cage that packages inside it some bioactive ingredient or some drug that maybe kills cells. Now, you don't want that drug to just be released willy-nilly inside the body. You want it to target specifically tumor cells, right? So how do you uncage the cage, right? So you basically, once you travel to the tumor cell, it recognizes some tumor-specific ingredient that binds to the cage. The cage says, okay, it's time to break apart. Let's all coordinate our motions to unpack our cells and release this payload.
I see. So it's really similar to hemoglobin in a lot of ways, but instead of going from where there's a lot of oxygen to where there's low oxygen, the idea here is act one way when you're not near a tumor cell and switch and open this cage, release a toxic medicine, but only when you run into a tumor.
Yes, exactly. And that relies on this ability of proteins to toggle between different states. Then these deep learning-based methods actually do let you build proteins with sequences that can encode two different kind of structures. And once you have the ability to do that, you can build a whole range of different little devices that can alter their shape, their symmetry, their size in response to different signals. And that's like a whole rich arena that we're exploring right now. I mean, aside from the cage releasing sort of systems, we also built like little rings that can change their diameter and their shape. So like we have like rings that can go from looking like triangles to squares.
I remember seeing those triangles and those squares in David's Nobel lecture.
Yes.
You presented some of those shape-shifting proteins.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very satisfying thing when your proteins look like platonic shapes that are kind of like seamlessly perfect triangles, perfect squares. They sit beautifully on a surface, so you can image them really well with electron microscopy. And actually, that was one of the most exciting days for me in science, I think, was struggling to build these kinds of systems for a very long time. And then one day we finally got these beautiful triangles to squares, not in and of themselves particularly interesting, but like beautiful, but also indicative that we can actually accurately, with relatively high molecular accuracy, build like toggleable assemblies like that.
Yes. Arvind's project started off with the question of, could you design switches? And we wanted, if you're going to design a switch, you have to be able to distinguish the on and the off state, so you know it got switched. So in his work, one of the things that we thought would be really easy to see would be if, for example, you could turn triangles into squares. Now, that's kind of abstract. Like, when do you ever need to turn triangles into squares unless you're a magician or something? But that same concept is now being elaborated to make new types of nanomachines that could be sort of the dream of nanomedicine, where you have like little nanomachines going around through your in circulation, getting rid of fibroses and other things. So it started off as a very academic kind of abstract problem, which I think soon could become very practically impactful.
Speaking of beautiful squares and elegant triangles, I heard that you're also an artist.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, like I said, like my interest in art goes way back, all the way back to childhood, really. But I think it was always arrested in a state of doodling for a very, very long time, because I got, I think, very limited instruction on an artistic front. And also it was just not viewed as a particularly useful skill. But somewhere around graduate school, I think I committed myself to lots of artistic projects that dramatically increased my like ability to draw and particularly do comics and stuff like that. So I was interested in drawing comics that were targeted at like historical education. So I did I was working for a long time on the history of China, but illustrated through 100 panels. I was working on the history of the early caliphate, so the Industrial Revolution, and with each iteration of historical event that I would try to target, I basically slowly improved my drawing ability. Wow. But that was really fun.
Do you think your art and your science come from the same place in you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I view them as totally overlapping. I mean, one of the things I'm excited about is trying in the future to synthesize them more. I mean, they come from the same wellspring of imagination and curiosity that I think fuels a lot of my interest in science. In general, I'm one of those people who thinks that regular life is very mundane and boring. So I enjoy the incredible vistas of imagination that science offers, and also history and other fields as well. All of knowledge, really.
So this is an audio podcast. Is there any way that folks listening could see some of the stuff that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's all been dutifully compiled on this website called Scriblopedia, which is a mixture of the word scribble and encyclopedia.
Gotcha. Scriblopedia. We might have a link in the show notes.
Beyond science, it's always been a delight to talk to Arvind, whether to look at his really amazing art that he's been creating for a long time, which I highly recommend, to his social commentary on a wide variety of things. And he has a tremendous sense of humor. So that's really been fun to have him in the lab.
I'm going to switch gears a little bit.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Throw some maybe philosophical questions at you. In your opinion, what makes somebody a good scientist?
Yeah, I think the first thing is that I think there are probably many personality types that can fit into the category of scientist. I myself did not view myself as one of those, actually, growing up. So I think a certain kind of scientist is very organized, you could say type A, very detail-oriented. And that is very important, note-taking, organizational skills, super important for being a good scientist. I think that's the canonical view of a good scientist. But another layer of it is also about creativity and curiosity, the willingness to not dismiss an area of knowledge just because you're unfamiliar with it, but actually diving deep into it and having the mental flexibility to pivot from what you're doing now to something totally different. And in fact, you can see that in David's career, his ability to pivot and adapt to new environments was insane. And that's definitely inspirational to me. But I think having that curiosity and creativity, I mean, part of it comes from an openness to ideas and willingness to synthesize them. I don't view creativity as the ability to generate ideas completely de novo. I view it as the synthesis of existing ideas in novel combinations. So how do you enhance your creativity? I think it's by getting more ideas or putting as many ideas into your brain as possible. So that's where curiosity comes in. That's why curiosity is sort of like the back end of creativity, the ability to go out there and seek out knowledge and ideas as much as you can. I also think that memory plays a role, the ability to maintain enough ideas in your brain that you can actually efficiently synthesize them is another component.
Got to have the RAM.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I guess this changes the paradigm here of breadth and depth, that maybe that's not that useful of a distinction, or maybe they connect in surprising ways.
Yeah, at the risk of saying something silly, I mean, I think breadth is its own kind of depth. You never know where the new idea is going to come in that's going to be revolutionary for your field. So you kind of have to have open eyes and preparedness for when and where that's coming. I can't speak for everyone, but in my strength as a scientist is definitely my willingness to just throw myself into something I don't know anything about. I think you don't have that much fear about having to learn new stuff, kind of pivot to a totally new thing. I mean, the pivot from my grad school work to here, even though I've tied it into a neat little continuous narrative, was actually pretty substantially different. Like the classes I took in graduate school are essentially non-overlapping with the classes many of the people would have taken who joined me here in postdoc. I might be the only evolutionary biologist. I don't know if that's true. Maybe you can speak to this because you've been here longer, but I think I might be the only evolutionary biologist to come through the lab with that as my PhD.
That definitely might be true. If you're an alumni and you're listening, let us know.
Yeah.
You know, you talked a lot about, as a scientist and as a student, you spent a lot of time wanting to understand, where complexity comes from. And that drove you into molecular biology and then into the work you do now, trying to create new instances of complexity. Where do you hope your research goes next? And what's next for you?
So basically, I think the major outstanding question for me that, again, has propelled me through all of this has been how does molecular complexity arise from, like, essentially disorder or chaos? And the answer in nature is evolution. Of course, in our lab, it's that our human minds coupled with AI can build totally new proteins. But I think the thing that I find puzzling and difficult to account for is that, and it's been largely ignored in the field of molecular evolution, is how you get folded proteins from random sequences. So there's millions and millions, billions of protein sequences that we know of, but there's actually only a pretty finite number of individual three-dimensional architectures called folds. Maybe there's a few thousand of them even, depending on how you classify them, into which all of that diversity can be fitted into roughly. And what we lack is a great explanation of how evolution can find like a totally new fold or a three-dimensional architecture. We know a lot about how you can take a given fold and diversify and multiply it endlessly to get new functions. But that initial step, which is pretty foundational for understanding the origins of biological complexity, is sort of unaccounted for.
That's really one of those fundamental cases of there's organization here, there's pattern here, there's complexity emerging here.
Yes, yeah. And some of that happened very close to the origin of life, which is like maybe a little harder to access with the tools we use in evolution typically. But some of it actually happened on shallower timescales. So there are examples of new proteins that have arisen on short branches within mammals or within animals or within plants. And I think my research program in the future will be to use the protein design and prediction methods that I used in my postdoc, synthesize those with the evolutionary questions for my PhD to try and address how like protein folding actually arises. By the way, it's funny enough, my research program is still being informed by angry arguments I had with creationists decades ago, or a decade ago, I guess. But yeah, one of the arguments is, you know, like take a protein of length 100 amino acids. There's 20 to the power of 100 possible combinations of sequences that could account for a protein of that length. That's more possible options than there are atoms in the known universe. So how did evolution, this dumb, blind, stochastic process, eventually discover those tiny islands of foldedness in this vast universe of trash, of things that don't fold, that don't actually have any biological function or structural integrity? So I think that's the process I really want to explore, and is like kind of, we don't have a great answer for that other than the hand-wavy argument of, well, you know, selection did it. Evolution has a lot of time. It's like kind of a massively parallelized experiment. Maybe eventually you can get there, but the probabilities are hard to stomach on that front. I want to give a more rigorous, coherent biophysical answer to the question by whatever approaches are available to me. I'm starting a lab at a research institute in Kansas City, Missouri, called the Stowers Institute. And I'm super excited about, you know, heading my own lab, kind of transitioning from being a postdoc to being this more leadership position. But hopefully we'll answer these fundamental questions about the origins of molecular order in deep time.
Wow. I look forward to seeing what your lab's going to discover there and where your curiosity is going to take you next. Thank you, Arvin, for coming on today.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Baker Lab podcast. Your host this episode was Ian Hayden. This episode was recorded at the Institute for Protein Design at the University of Washington School of Medicine. It was produced by Nora McNamara Bordwick, Rithi Biswas, Ian Hayden, and Roni Weissman, with help from Anisha Sagal, Joe Min, and Nathan Greenwood. Art music is by Kevin MacLeod. Please subscribe and leave a rating if you like this show, and we'll see you next time.